Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 153. It's Monday, February 28th. I'm recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, I wanted to remind people that are terrestrial broadcasts. I've had two shows that have been aired, the original and a rebroadcast, but we added last week an additional broadcast. So the two original ones are on Tuesdays at 9 a.m. on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo, but last week we added an additional rebroadcast at a different time to see how that works out, and that is at 5:30 p.m. on Tuesdays. Okay, well, if you are not able to get to the terrestrial broadcast, you can listen to it online live at toledoradio.org. Listen to We Act Radio. Okay, well, let's get to the news. And, of course, we're starting with COVID-19. Still hasn't ended yet. And finally, the CDC has issued new guidance. And most people are seeing this as mask guidance, but it goes a little farther than that. So I think a good summary of that is from your local epidemiologist on Substack. Here we go. Last Friday, the CDC provided on and off ramps for public health mitigation measures like masks going forward. The CDC made it clear that the sole purpose of the new framework is to prevent severe disease and thus not overwhelm hospital systems at the local level. So what's the guidance? Briefly, the CDC packaged three metrics for every county in the U.S. One, new COVID-19 hospital admissions over the previous week. Two, the percentage of hospital beds occupied by COVID patients. And three, new cases per 100,000 people over the previous week. They then corresponded these metrics to categories low, green, medium, yellow, and high, orange. The CDC then mapped these metrics to behaviors like masking. So, for example, if a county is in the orange medium level, everyone needs to mask indoors. If a county is in the yellow, then only high-risk individuals should mask. I'm sorry, the orange is the high, yellow is the medium. The CDC provided a live map that displays the color of every county. It will be updated weekly. Today, about 70% of counties are in yellow or green. In other words, about 70% of counties don't need to mask indoors per the CDC recommendations. Okay, well, let's get to your local epidemiologist's praises of this particular plan. Cases included. The CDC ended up integrating case metrics into the framework, and this was 100% the correct call. Before this, rumor suggested that the CDC was only going to use hospitalizations to map behaviors. But this is inherently flawed because once hospitalizations increase, transmission in the community has already been high for about 3 to 4 weeks. So I'm glad they decided not to do this. A layered approach. The CDC did not just map these metrics to masks, they also mapped the metrics to other tools like rapid testing, when and how, ventilation of spaces, vaccines, treatment, etc. I was very happy to see this. Yes, masks work, but so do all the other tools we have, significantly underutilized throughout the pandemic. Dial up and dial down. The end of the surge is not the end of a pandemic. We need to be prepared and ready for the next. It may never come, but in the high likelihood that another wave does come, we need clear guidance. Critiques? I wouldn't be a scientist without critiques. I think these critiques are pretty big, too. Case level definition. It's not clear to me how they arrived at their new case metric of 200 cases per 100,000 population in the past week. Before this, masks were needed at 50 cases per 100,000, a quarter of the level. No scientific justification was provided. And I am shocked the CDC is comfortable with this high level of transmission given long COVID-19 implications, given that not everyone has access to the vaccine, and given high excess death to high-risk individuals, like we're seeing in Denmark with high levels of transmission. Vaccines are great, but not perfect. To demonstrate, the CDC's old guidance said that 3,074 counties should wear a mask indoors. Their new guidance says only 1,200 counties need to mask. This is a big difference, and honestly, I'm a bit uncomfortable with this high level of transmission in the community. I also didn't appreciate a few places where the guidance said, quote, if you are immunocompromised or high risk for severe disease, talk to your healthcare provider. So, this framework isn't public health guidance. This is individual level guidance and only for certain individuals. The CDC is the public health leader and really needs to lead that way. As a boosted individual, I know my individual risk is very, very low, but I also understand that other people's risks are high. I would like guidance on how to adequately contribute to society for these folks' benefit too, not just until they show up at the hospital. Because of these two critiques, I will still be wearing my mask at yellow, the middle level. Once we reach green, which should be soon, I'll celebrate taking it off, at least until we reach yellow again. Okay, well, another good summary of this change actually comes from the American Medical Association. They made a statement on the CDC's COVID-19 update. This is from the president of the American Medical Association. Today's updated recommendations from the CDC reflect a new approach to monitoring COVID-19 in communities. Vaccines work. They are effective in preventing severe COVID, hospitalization, and death. And we urge all Americans to stay up to date on their COVID-19 vaccines, including getting a booster dose when eligible. But even as some jurisdictions lift masking requirements, we must grapple with the fact that millions of people in the U.S. are immunocompromised, more susceptible to severe COVID outcomes, or still too young to be eligible for vaccines. In light of these facts, I personally will continue to wear a mask in most indoor public settings, and I urge all Americans to consider doing the same, especially in places like pharmacies, grocery stores, on public transportation, locations all of us, regardless of vaccination status or risk factors, must visit regularly. Although masks may no longer be required indoors in many parts of the U.S., we know that wearing a well-fitted mask is an effective way to protect ourselves and our communities, including the most vulnerable, from COVID-19, particularly in indoor settings when physical distancing is not possible. Wearing a mask, physical distancing, and staying home if you're sick are small but important protective measures that can help us all stay safe. While the Omicron surge has declined, COVID-19 is not gone. We must remain adaptable and vigilant in confronting this unpredictable virus. Okay, well, next up, also from your local epidemiologist, this is a little bit of a cautionary tale and talking, this is an update on the situation in Denmark. After initially escaping the Omicron wave without overwhelming hospital and very little mortality, Denmark decided to remove all public health mitigation measures at the beginning of February. This decision was made regardless of their exponential out-of-this-world COVID-19 transmission rate at the time. While controversial and risky, the policy decision provided the world a front-row seat to a natural experiment. Are Denmark's vaccination rates, 10th most vaccinated and 4th most boosted population in the world, which equates to an 83% vaccination rate overall and a 62% overall booster rate, is this high enough to go back to normal despite a massive case surge? What would this look like? Well, to no one's surprise, cases continued to skyrocket. Interestingly, ICUs decreased but then plateaued and just recently began increasing. Denmark's deaths continued to exponentially increase. In fact, just recently they reached a record-breaking high. Many believe the Danish policy was a mistake. One reliable signal of the severity of the pandemic is excess mortality, as it removes all the noise from case definitions. Denmark's report this week found a substantially high number of excess deaths, particularly among those age 85 plus years old. Unfortunately, this data is delayed, so excess deaths may continue to increase too. This confirms that even though there is a high vaccination rate, the vulnerable are not guaranteed protection in a high transmission environment. Vaccines work great, but are not perfect. Vaccination rates play a big role, but as Denmark has shown, it's not the only factor at play. Other country-level factors like general health, age distribution, strength of a healthcare system, and the availability of social safety nets also need to be taken into account. The country also needs to decide how much excess death and excess morbidity, which comes often in the case of long COVID-19, that we're willing to culturally accept. The U.S. is not Denmark. The U.S. currently ranks a measly 64th for fully vaccinated and 54th for boosters in the world. We also have a fragmented healthcare and public health system and little to no safety nets. The conversation on how to control the virus and prepare in the U.S. is still important and very much needed. Dropping all public health mitigation measures now and forever is just not a choice we have. Okay, well, next up from MedPage Today, a little more information on the transmissibility of Omicron in households. This is from the CDC. Vaccination curbed but didn't halt Omicron in households. Risk of contracting COVID-19 during the Omicron surge was higher when the index case, that's the initial case in the household, was unvaccinated. Though this risk was still high among vaccinated cases, researchers found. Among index cases who were unvaccinated, the attack rate in household context was 64%, compared with 44% in context of index cases who had completed their primary vaccination series within 5 months, and 43% among those who were vaccinated and boosted, as reported in the CDC's Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report. Not surprisingly, attack rates were lower when index cases isolated or wore a mask at home. Among household contacts of index patients who isolated, the attack rate was 41% versus 68% for those who did not isolate. These rates were 40% for contacts of index cases who reported ever wearing a mask at home, quote, during their potentially infectious period, versus 69% for those who never wore a mask at home. These findings emphasize the importance of a multi-pronged strategy to prevent COVID transmission within households, including isolation, mask wearing, and being up to date on vaccination. Transmission occurred in 68% of households and an overall attack rate of the individuals in the household of 53%. Okay, well, as we've seen in this pandemic, things change fast, and this is illustrated in the story from the LA Times. Nearly half of Biden's 500 million free COVID tests still unclaimed. Nearly half of the 500 million COVID-19 tests the Biden administration recently made available to the public still have not been claimed as virus cases plummet and people feel less urgency to test. The White House says Americans have placed 68 million orders for packages of tests, which leaves about 46% of the stock of tests still available to be ordered. So if you want those tests and haven't got them yet, feel free to order them. And as I've been reporting here in recent weeks and months, vaccination rates are declining, continue to decline. This from Associated Press. U.S. vaccination drive is bottoming out as Omicron subsides. The average number of Americans getting their first shot is down to about 90,000 a day, the lowest point since the very first few days of the U.S. vaccination campaign in December 2020, and hopes of any substantial improvement in the immediate future have largely evaporated. About 76% of the U.S. population has received at least one shot. Less than 65% of all Americans are fully vaccinated. The bottoming out of demand for the first round of vaccinations is especially evident in conservative areas around the country. Okay, and moving worldwide, this from Reuters. COVID vaccine supply for global program outstrips demand for first time. The global project to share COVID-19 vaccines is struggling to place more than 300 million doses. In the latest sign, the problem with vaccinating the world is now more about demand than supply. Last year, wealthy nations snapped most of the available shots to inoculate their own citizens first, meaning less than a third of people in low-income countries have been vaccinated so far, compared with more than 70% in richer nations. As supply and donations have ramped up, however, poor nations are facing hurdles such as gaps in cold chain shortage, vaccine hesitancy, and a lack of money to support distribution networks, public health officials told Reuters. We will only close the vaccine equity gap once and for all if we are able to help countries roll out vaccines rapidly and at scale. Well, of course, it's a little bit of a mischaracterization to say that it's a demand problem. It's more of an infrastructure problem. There's plenty of demand in many parts of the world, but if you have the vaccine doses, but you can't get them places because you either don't have the transportation, the refrigeration, or whatever, or even just the manpower, it's very hard to do. So this is where we need more resource investment to put an end to this pandemic and to build infrastructure for the next inevitable pandemic. So what's the latest on the U.S. doing something about that? Well, this from the Hill. Advocates criticize tepid Biden request for global COVID-19 funding. Democratic lawmakers and advocacy groups say the Biden administration's request for $5 billion from Congress for efforts to fight COVID-19 globally, including vaccinations, falls far short of what is needed. They had been pushing for months for $17 billion to step up global vaccination and treatment efforts, but the White House asked for less than a third of that amount in informal talks with Congress last week without offering an explanation. The one campaign which has been helping lead the push for greater global vaccination efforts called the Biden's administration request, quote, tepid and disappointing. President Biden has said he wants to lead, said Tom Hart, the group's president. He's going to host a summit sometime in the first quarter to galvanize global leaders. You can't show up to that with a paltry commitment, so we're pretty disappointed. Well, folks, a good example of a bad trend that happens chronically, that's endemic in public health, that when there's a crisis, people pay attention to it, but as soon as it recedes, it just leaves our field of vision. And those boom and bust cycles do not work well when what you need when a crisis hits is an adequate capacity to deal with it. Clearly, this country, let alone second and third world countries around the world, have not had the capacity to deal with this pandemic, even though we've had vaccines available for well over a year. Okay, well, let's get to the local Lucas County COVID-19 update. We're going to be, this is going to be getting shorter and shorter as things change here, and some things are actually, they're ending reporting on stuff. It gets shorter. So basically the summary for this week is that the numbers we're seeing are back to where we were in early August as the Delta wave was growing. With the new CDC guidelines, we're kind of in the middle there, that yellow category, although the new hospitalizations is in there, it just makes it into their higher category. But the cases are going down quickly and are in the lower category, below the 200 cases per 100,000 people per week. So that's good, and we're definitely moving in the right direction. The Lucas County average number of daily cases over the most recent 7-day period was 41, down from 106 the previous week, so still dropping quickly. And the testing positivity rates are dropping quickly all over the place. That's locally in Ohio and in the U.S. And actually, locally in Ohio, we're doing better than the U.S. as a whole in many respects. Each of the testing positivity rates are around 5%, 5.2% in Lucas County, 4.7% in Ohio, and 5% in the United States as a whole. Nursing homes continue to have active cases. It's kind of leveled off here. Actually went up a little bit over the last couple of weeks, had 71 active cases. The two prior weeks had 66 and 69 cases. That's 42 residents and 29 staff with active COVID-19 infections in long-term care facilities in Lucas County. We did not have any additional deaths reported in those nursing homes. Oh, that's good news. The schools are no longer reporting, so we don't have that data, so that's dropping out of our local report. The University of Toledo, though, still, because they're associated with a medical facility, does surveillance testing, so it is one cross-section in our community of what's going on. And we've seen an additional drop in the number of cases identified there, down to 26 from 37 the previous week, which has been dropping, a quarter or a third of what it was even several weeks before that. So that's good. And the surveillance testing, which is the random testing that they do in the UT community, they only identified two positives, and that was 0.3% of the people they tested. So that's a big drop. So good news on that front. And thank you again, University of Toledo and University of Toledo Medical Center for doing that surveillance testing. Okay, hospitalizations are still dropping steadily in both Lucas County and Ohio. Deaths nationally are still hanging in there, but they've continued to drop. Now they're under 1,900 per day, which is still a very large number, but it's getting to the point where we're going to drop out COVID-19 as the number one leading cause of death in the U.S., and we get back to the normal, where heart disease and cancer are what kills us most likely. So, yeah, but looks like COVID-19 will probably continue to be the third leading cause of death for quite a while. My guess is this year, even without much happening the rest of the year, we've had enough deaths already that will probably qualify as the number three leading cause of death. But there's a big gap between the first two and four, and COVID falling nice and neatly in that big area to come in as the third leading cause of death. Okay. Vaccines. This has been decreasing, as I said in that earlier Associated Press story, and I'm actually going to start just reporting this less often, like monthly, because it's gotten even slower. So right now, we've got 64.9% of the total population in the U.S. being fully vaccinated, and 28.3% of the total U.S. population boosted. Not particularly great numbers, but it's going up very slowly, like maybe 0.2-0.3% a week, and even more slowly in Ohio and Lucas County, which drag behind 7-8 points behind that. Lucas County only has 55.9% of people fully vaccinated, although our boosted rate is similar to the national rate, because of those people that have been fully vaccinated, a higher proportion of them in Lucas County and Ohio have gotten boosted. So you got a big divide there, a lot more. You got more unvaccinated, but you've also got a little more of people that are fully vaccinated getting boosted. So that doesn't seem to change much, so I'm not going to report on that every week anymore. But you are listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo, We Act Radio. Just for the Health of It is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. Okay, well, unfortunately, we've had a war start in the last week, and my friends, war is a public health issue, and we're just going to hit two facets of it here with a few stories. This from Reuters. Ukraine reports higher Chernobyl radiation after Russians capture plant. Ukraine said last Friday it had recorded increased radiation levels from the defunct Chernobyl nuclear power plant a day after the site was captured by Russian forces due to military activity causing radioactive dust to rise into the air. The readings reported by the regulator of up to 9.5 microsieverts per hour are low and remain within the operational range measured in the exclusion zone since it was established, the International Atomic Energy Association said. The France-based independent nuclear watchdog CRIRAD said in a statement it was trying to verify and cross-check the information at their laboratory. If the dose rates recorded correspond to real values, the situation is extremely worrying, adding that further research is needed to interpret the data. The resuspension of soil from military activities or damage to nuclear facilities, being either storage or waste or the containment structure, could be one of the reasons for the rise in radioactivity levels. The area has many high-risk installations, including radioactive waste processing and storage facilities, most of them unsecured. Other reactors in Ukraine also pose a safety risk in case of an accident, the watchdog said. While it was possible to reduce the potential risk by shutting down the reactors, Ukraine depends on nuclear power for more than 50% of their electricity supply. Next up from the New York Times, another casualty of Russia's invasion, Ukraine's ability to contain the coronavirus. While Ukraine is under attack by Russia, Ukraine's civilian population is also under siege from the coronavirus, a situation only likely to worsen. The fighting in Ukraine's east is forcing a mass migration to the west that is crowding mass transit centers and trains and jamming roads. Video images of the largest number of Ukrainians on the move show understandably few signs of face coverings, even as the country is just getting past a record high point in its infection rate. The coronavirus outlook for those fleeing the situation is grim, according to Dr. Eric Toner, a senior scholar at the Center for Health Security at the School of Public Health at Johns Hopkins University. They're quite vulnerable, and as people huddle together, either sheltering or evacuating in crowded buses, trains, and cars, maybe in hotels and refugee camps, is going to cause a reversal of the progress, he said. They can't maintain distance and don't have access to masks. Many people are heading to smaller towns and villages or crossing the border into Poland, Hungary, Slovakia, and Romania, and the flow of refugees will likely affect those countries' pandemic situations as well. Senior Biden administration officials say that between 1 million and 5 million people in the Ukraine could seek safety in some other part of that country or in a neighboring community. Last Thursday, the United Nations High Commission for Refugees said it was already increasing its operations in Ukraine and neighboring countries. Dr. Toner said that he expected Ukraine's neighbors to see a rise in their COVID case numbers and additional stress on their healthcare systems from refugees, but those problems will be worse inside Ukraine. They're going to be caring for COVID patients along with war victims, he said. They're going to be understaffed because of the war, and it's going to harm their chances of keeping patients in isolation or having social distancing. It's going to be a mess. And related to that, from Reuters, medical oxygen running out in Ukraine as war rages, World Health Organization warns. Ukraine is running out of oxygen supplies that critically ill people need, the World Health Organization said on Sunday, calling for safe passage for emergency imports as combat rages. The oxygen supply situation is nearing a very dangerous point in Ukraine. Trucks are unable to transport oxygen supplies from plants to hospitals across the country, including the capital, Kyiv. The majority of hospitals could exhaust their oxygen reserves within the next 24 hours. Some have already run out. This puts thousands of lives at risk. Of course, the trauma and dislocation of war is the primary public health effect, but there are ripple effects all over the place from such trauma. As this war started, I was reminded of the quote that says, "Trying to win a war is like trying to win an earthquake." Okay, well, let's return back to the U.S. for some more trauma-related stories. This from The Hill. Firearm deaths become leading cause of trauma-related death. Firearms are now the leading cause of trauma-related deaths in the U.S., according to a study published last Tuesday, overtaking motor vehicle crashes as the top cause of years of potential life lost. The CDC calculates years of potential life lost by subtracting an individual's age when they died from the standard year of 80, which is roughly the U.S. life expectancy. The agency then sums the numbers of years lost across different causes of death. The study looked at data from 2009 to 2018. In the first few years that researchers looked at, motor vehicle crashes accounted for more years of potential life loss than firearms. However, in 2017, firearms exceeded motor vehicle crashes and continued to do so through 2018. In 2018, the majority of the nearly 40,000 firearm deaths, over 85%, occurred among men. Around half of these deaths were due to firearm suicide among white men. Firearm homicide was the highest among black men, with these deaths accounting for about a fifth of firearm deaths in 2018. Researchers noted that up to 70% of suicides are based on impulsive behavior, and suicide attempts usually occur after about 3 hours of contemplation. The availability of firearms make the impulsive behavior somewhat less reversible, and the effectiveness of firearms makes the attempts often successful, they wrote. Yeah, if you can call that success. And further research shows us some of the reasons for the increase in these trauma deaths by firearm. This from the Washington Post. Stand Your Ground laws linked to 11% rise in U.S. firearm homicide, study says. Stand Your Ground laws are associated with an 11% increase in monthly firearm homicide rates, according to a new study, with especially striking jumps in southern states that embrace Stand Your Ground early on. That amounts to 700 additional homicides each year, according to the findings published in JAMA Network Open, a peer-reviewed medical journal. Justifications for Stand Your Ground often center around these laws actually having some protective effect on public safety and deterring violence, said David Humphreys, an associate professor at the University of Oxford and one of the paper's authors, said in an interview. There doesn't seem to be any evidence to show that, and, you know, we only seem to see the opposite effect. Some advocates have promoted Stand Your Ground as a way to reduce violence by ensuring that victims can retaliate against an assailant and deterring crime, but researchers note that no state saw drops in homicide rates after passing such laws. Okay, I want to switch gears and do a little bit of follow-up on a story I've covered before here about pharmacy benefit managers making the pharmacy industry difficult. This from MedPage Today. Provider groups miffed over the Federal Trade Commission's failure to authorize study of pharmacy benefit managers, the middlemen. Pharmacy and provider organizations are disappointed with the decision by the Federal Trade Commission to not launch a study into the marketing and financial practices of pharmacy benefit managers, at least for now. These pharmacy middlemen siphon billions in profits intended for patients and have been allowed to operate with little oversight for far too long, the Coalition for Pharmacy Benefit Management Reform, a group composed of patients, healthcare providers, and payers, said in a statement. And related to that, from the Federal Trade Commission, as reported in Politico, the FTC's top economist resigned amid dispute over pharma study. The Federal Trade Commission's top economist abruptly quit last week amid internal disagreements over a proposed study into pharmacy benefit managers, three people familiar with the situation said. When you've got high level of staff that are quitting over a governmental action, that's usually a clue. Where there's smoke, there's fire. This is a problem. Okay, well, let's switch gears again and do a few stories here on abortion. This from the Associated Press. Over half of U.S. abortions are now done with pills, not surgery. More than half of U.S. abortions are now done with pills rather than surgery, an upward trend that spiked during the pandemic with the increase in telemedicine, a report released last Thursday shows. In 2020, pills accounted for 54% of all U.S. abortions, up from roughly 44% in 2019. The preliminary numbers come from the Guttmacher Institute, a research group that supports abortion rights. That group, by contacting providers, collects more comprehensive abortion data than the U.S. government. Use of abortion pills has been rising since 2000, when the Food and Drug Administration approved mifepristone, the main drug used in medication abortions. The new increase is not surprising, especially during COVID, said Dr. Margie Gold, a family medicine physician and abortion provider in New York City. She said patients seeking abortions at her clinic have long chosen the pills over the medical procedure. The pandemic prompted a rise in telemedicine, an FDA action that allowed abortion pills to be mailed so patients could skip in-person visits to get them. These changes could have contributed to the increase in use. The FDA made the change permanent last December, meaning millions of women can get a prescription via an online consultation and receive the pills through the mail. That move led to stepped-up efforts by abortion opponents to seek additional restrictions on medication abortions through state legislatures. Okay, well, in drilling down to one of the fronts of anti-abortion efforts, this from Politico, abortion pill use spikes in Texas as thousands of patients circumvent state's ban. Texans have been ordering abortion pills online at record rates in the wake of the state's law banning the procedure after 6 weeks of pregnancy, according to a new study published in JAMA Network Open. Orders for the drug from the international nonprofit Aid Access spiked 1,180% in the first week after the Texas law took effect in September, increasing from about 11 purchases per day to more than 137 per day. And though orders decreased over the next few months, researchers found they remain 175% higher than before the Texas law took effect. We know that if you suddenly restrict abortion, the need for abortion does not go away, Abigail Aiken, a professor at the University of Texas at Austin and the lead author of the study, said. We know abortions in clinics have dropped precipitously in Texas, but we wanted to look at whether people were looking for other ways to end their pregnancies. This new data, she added, is certainly suggestive that that is the case. State data shows a drop of 2,149 clinic-based abortions in September of 2021. In that same month, Aid Access received 1,831 requests for pills from Texas patients, which would account for over 85% of the decrease in clinic-based abortions. I don't want to say the law hasn't forced anyone to remain pregnant, Aiken stressed, but I think it's very likely that out-of-state care and self-managed abortion have made up the majority of the difference. Texans' options became further limited when the state barred the mailing of abortion pills earlier this year, one of several states to do so after the Biden administration moved to lift long-standing federal restrictions on telemedicine prescription and mail delivery of the drugs. Yet because Aid Access and other online providers are sending the medication to patients' homes in discreet packaging, and some are based outside the country and can't be targeted for violating the law, the state has not yet been able to prevent the practice. Okay, well, the third story on abortion we have comes from Bloomberg, a deeper dive into the availability of this abortion drug. The abortion pill is safer than Tylenol and almost impossible to get. Mifepristone may be the least marketed pharmaceutical product in the U.S. There aren't any ads for it on TV. Most doctors can't prescribe it. Pharmacists don't know much about it since it doesn't sit on the shelves at CVS or Walgreens. It would be reasonable to assume this is all because mifepristone is exceptionally dangerous, but it sends fewer people to the ER than Tylenol or Viagra. It's also highly effective when used as intended to induce an abortion. When the U.S. Food and Drug Administration approved mifepristone 21 years ago, it was known as RU486 and handles the most important advance in reproductive health since the birth control pill. Time magazine had called it the pill that changes everything. It was supposed to provide an attractive alternative to surgical procedures, which can involve sedation, a visit to a healthcare facility, and obviously a great deal of medical expertise. At the time, the abortion battleground was, by and large, women's health clinics. The pill, in theory, could allow women to bypass clinics and throngs of protesters almost entirely. Yet, in the two decades since FDA approval, mifepristone has failed to reach liftoff. If anything, it's receded from view. A labyrinth of regulatory restrictions has kept it intentionally out of reach. Most abortions in the U.S. are still done by surgical procedure, even though the majority of people ending their pregnancy do so early enough to take the pill instead. Almost 80% of adults, including two-thirds of women, don't even know medication abortion exists, according to the Kaiser Family Foundation. Of course, the last story shows that we're seeing that change rather quickly. Okay, Jessica Nohavandi, a pharmacist and the co-founder of online drug delivery service Honeybee Health, was surprised to learn her friends were among them. At the beginning of the pandemic, she decided she wanted to sell the pill through her site. When she mentioned it in a group text with friends, not one of the 10 college-educated 30-something women had ever heard of an abortion pill. Even among her colleagues, she sees how this could happen. In pharmacy school, you don't really learn about medication abortion, she says. Her training didn't entirely ignore the drug involved. There was just very little emphasis on what it was used for. Basically, we learn about the meds, but don't talk too much about medication abortion. Nohavandi felt driven to do something about it, though it wasn't clear much could be done. For as long as the abortion pill has been marketed, the FDA has required it to be given at a doctor's office. That's not the only quirk specific to mifepristone either. Prescribers have to get certified to dispense the pill and then counsel patients on the risk of having it. Then they have to get them to sign a form reiterating the facts they were just told to their faces. These rules may sound largely procedural, but they're logistical headaches that don't apply even to some highly addictive drugs. Without them, a general practitioner could prescribe the pill via telemedicine, have it sent to their patients by mail. This would be particularly useful for the almost 9 out of 10 American women who live in counties without an abortion clinic. Of course, this has happened recently where the Biden administration lifted that previous story. So this is rapidly changing. Okay. For years, activists, healthcare professionals, and medical researchers have been building a case that the abortion pill should be treated like other medications that come with similarly few medical concerns. With the U.S. on the precipice of a new era of restricted abortion access, the Supreme Court is hearing a lawsuit that could overturn Roe v. Wade this year. Their cause is more urgent than ever. The FDA last year reviewed its restrictions on mifepristone, but ultimately decided to keep all but one in place. Women no longer have to pick up the pill at a doctor's office. That was a huge win, says Nohavandi. But that the FDA left all the other idiosyncratic hoops in place is hugely disappointing. Plus, the agency added another. Pharmacies such as hers have to get certified to distribute the drug, a rule that only applies to 40 FDA-approved drugs out of more than 19,000. There's no certification process in place yet. Creating one could take months. So far, Walgreens Boots Alliance Incorporated isn't seeking certification. CVS Health Corp couldn't comment on whether it plans to do so. I don't think the fight is anywhere near over, Nohavandi says. In the U.S., getting the pill can require maneuvering absurdly complex situations. Graham Chalias, a family medicine doctor in the Hawaiian island of Kauai, which has no abortion clinic, had to send his patients to Oahu, a 40-minute flight each way, costing a $150 round trip at least just to pick up mifepristone from a certified provider. There's no other medicine that I provide that I have to have in the clinic that you just can't write a prescription for it and have it shipped, Chalias says. If the U.S. enters a post-Roe world, legal abortion will likely disappear in almost half of the states, unless there's a way to get mifepristone into those places. That raises a question. Can states ban the shipment of mifepristone if the FDA explicitly says it's allowed? A Massachusetts case may provide some answers. When the FDA approved that powerful, long-acting opioid Zohydro in 2013, the governor tried to ban the sale of the drug in his state. The drug maker sued, and the U.S. district judge ruled that the state did not have the authority to overstep the FDA. This could provide the framework for a legal argument against state bans on mail-order abortion pills. If it works, it could also mean the pill remains available in places that ban abortion altogether. This idea that the states can't do something that frustrates the purpose of federal law, that's the strongest way to go at mifepristone. There's no guarantee it'll work, but it's worth a shot. The anti-abortion movement has been trying these pretty outlandish strategies on so many different fronts for decades, and a lot of times they fail, but sometimes they don't. And now we are where we are. It's time to get creative. Amen.
And now, a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you suffer from moderate to severe disenchantment from rampant capitalism running the lives of you and your loved ones? From daily sexism that can't be mansplained away? From endemic racism that nobody seems to see? Try Eliminol. It's the blue pill from Placebo Pharmaceutical Corporation. It's everything you think it is. The blue pill is a choice you'll never need to feel bad about ever again. Warning, use of Eliminol may lead to addiction in conjunction with a profound sense of not caring that you are addicted, or caring for much of anything else at all, for that matter. If you have any residual concerns, call our lifelong customer hotline, 1-800-CALLUS. Call us whenever, callous always. We now return you to your regular programming, bringing you non-commercial radio, featuring locally produced content and fresh perspectives from non-corporate persons. Good luck with that.
Okay, well, let's switch gears a little bit and look at intimate partner violence worldwide. This from Medical Express. More than a quarter of women have experienced intimate partner violence in their lifetimes, finds new study. New research published in The Lancet estimates that over 1 in 4 women have experienced domestic violence within their lifetime. Using data from the World Health Organization Global Database on the Prevalence of Violence Against Women, which covers 90% of women worldwide, these new estimates indicate that prior to the COVID-19 pandemic, 27% of ever-partnered women aged 15 to 49 had experienced physical and/or sexual violence from an intimate partner in their lifetime, with 1 in 7 or 13% experiencing recent violence from an intimate partner, that is, within 12 months of the survey. Regional variations by global burden of disease classifications reveal that the lifetime prevalence of intimate partner violence among women aged 15 to 49 was highest in Oceania at 49% and Central Sub-Saharan Africa at 44%. The regions with the lowest lifetime intimate partner violence prevalence estimates were Central Asia at 18% and Central Europe at 16%. And in a related story, back to the U.S., this from ABC News, sexual assault reports increase at U.S. military academies. Reported sexual assaults at the U.S. military academies increased sharply during the 2020-2021 school year as students returned to in-person classes during the coronavirus pandemic. The increase continues what officials believe is an upward trend at the academies, despite an influx of new sexual assault prevention and treatment programs. The latest increase comes as Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin and other leaders struggle to curb sexual assaults across the military. Amid escalating criticism of Capitol Hill, lawmakers are demanding better prevention efforts and more aggressive prosecutions. Austin and others have acknowledged that while they continue to study what works and what doesn't, they haven't yet found the answers. Well, my friends, if you have a historically patriarchal organization that's hierarchical and built on the fundamental acceptance of violence, why would we be surprised? Trying to prevent sexual assault in the military is probably trying to swim upstream. We find similar things in other professions, such as law enforcement, where violence is integral to part of the training and the self-selection of people that go into law enforcement or the military. You see much more domestic violence and sexual assault. Okay, well, that's a tad depressing, so why don't we switch focus to depression. This from Medical Express. Overlooked and underfunded. Experts call for united action to reduce the global burden of depression. The world is failing to tackle the persisting and increasingly serious global crisis of depression it is facing, according to a Lancet and World Psychiatric Association Commission on Depression, which calls for a whole-of-society response to reducing the global burden of depression. Despite abundant evidence that much can be done to prevent depression and aid recovery, even in resource-limited settings, an estimated 5% of the adult population around the world in any year are living with depression. In high-income countries, about half of people suffering from depression are not diagnosed or treated, and this rises to 80 or 90% in low- and middle-income countries. The COVID-19 pandemic has created additional challenges with social isolation, bereavement, uncertainty, hardship, and limited access to healthcare, taking a serious toll on the mental health of millions. Depression is a common condition worldwide. Yet despite this, many myths continue to surround it, perpetuating inaction. These include common misconceptions that depression is simply sadness, a sign of weakness, or restricted to certain cultural groups. The commissioner stressed that depression is a distinct health condition characterized by its persistence, substantial effect on daily functioning, and long-term health consequences. It can affect anyone, regardless of gender, background, social class, or age. There is variability in types and prevalence of depressive symptoms and signs among cultures and populations. The risk of depression rises in settings of adversity, including poverty, violence, displacement, and gender, racial, and other forms of discrimination. Depression is linked to a wide variety of chronic physical illnesses, and a person's physical health can influence their mental health and vice versa. At its worst, depression can lead to suicide. Studies indicate that 70 to 80% of people who die by suicide in high-income countries and around half of those in low-income and middle-income countries suffer from mental illness, of which depression is the most common cause. Depression also has enormous under-recognized social and economic tolls on individuals, families, communities, and countries. Even before the COVID-19 pandemic, the loss in economic productivity linked to depression cost the global economy an estimated $1 trillion a year. There's arguably no other health condition which is as common, as burdensome, as universal, and as treatable as depression, yet it receives little policy attention and resources, said Commission Co-Chair Associate Professor Christian Keiling from the Universidade Federal do Rio Grande do Sul in Brazil. Effective psychosocial and medical treatments are difficult to assess. Access. While high levels of stigma still prevent many people, including the high proportion of adolescents and young people at risk for or experiencing depression, from seeking the help required to have healthy and productive lives. The Commission stresses the need for whole-of-society strategies that reduce exposure to both adverse experiences in childhood, including neglect and trauma, and across the lifespan to lower the prevalence of depression. Interventions are also needed at the individual level, focusing on lifestyle factors, for example, smoking, alcohol consumption, physical inactivity, and other risk factors such as intimate partner violence and stressful life events such as bereavement or financial crisis. Prevention is the most neglected aspect of depression. This in part because most interventions are outside of the health sector, said co-author Dr. Lakshmi Vijayakumar from the Suicide Prevention Center and Voluntary Health Services in Chennai, India. In the face of the lifelong effects of adolescent depression, from difficulty in school and future relationships to risk of substance abuse, self-harm, and suicide, investing in depression prevention is excellent value for money. It is crucial that we put into practice evidence-based interventions that support parenting, reduce violence in the family and bullying at school, as well as promoting mental health at work and addressing loneliness in older adults. Common risk factors and high rates of depression among people with chronic health problems also support shared preventive approaches. Ultimately, greater investment is needed to ensure that people receive the care they need where and when they need it. And the Commission underscores the importance of whole-of-government actions to reduce the damaging effects of poverty, gender inequity, and other social inequities on mental health. Policies that reduce racial or ethnic inequities, systematic disadvantages experienced by women, and support the fair distribution of income through universal health coverage, and expanding opportunities for educational attainment can be potentially powerful preventive strategies. Tackling the climate emergency, the COVID-19 pandemic, and other global and regional emergencies that exacerbate existing inequities and threats to health, including pursuit of the UN Sustainable Development Goals, must also be vital parts to prevent depression. Okay, well, next up from Medical Express, a story that gets to the link between depression and physical health. Depression linked to heart disease and type 2 diabetes. A lower frequency of depressive episodes is associated with a 34% decreased risk of coronary artery disease and a 33% decreased risk of type 2 diabetes, irrespective of lifestyle risk factors and genetic susceptibility. The findings are published in Nature Cardiovascular Research. Okay, well, next up in a somewhat related story, this from MedPage Today. Gender-affirming meds have drastic impact on suicide risk in trans youth. Gender-affirming medical interventions may help protect transgender and non-binary youth from suicide, a study suggested. Those who initiated puberty blockers and gender-affirming hormones had a 73% lower odds of suicidality versus youth who didn't have any gender-affirming treatments. There was a 60% lower odds of depression over a 12-month period. Use of puberty blockers and gender-affirming hormones were not linked to lower anxiety levels, though. As evidence of how common mental health struggles are for this population, 57% of the study cohort of youth aged 13 to 20 had moderate to severe depression at baseline. On top of that, half struggled with moderate to severe anxiety, and 43% reported self-harm or suicidal thoughts. Despite this, by the end of the year-long observation study, only 66% of these individuals received treatment with either puberty blockers, gender-affirming hormones, or both, while a third of youth didn't receive any of these gender-affirming medical interventions. Our findings have important policy implications, suggesting that the recent wave of legislation restricting access to gender-affirming care may have significant negative outcomes on the well-being of trans and non-binary youth. Beyond the need to address anti-transgender legislation, there is an additional need for medical systems and insurance providers to decrease barriers and expand access to gender-affirming care. But gender-affirming medical interventions alone won't be enough to help this vulnerable population, as they still face much higher rates of suicide than the national average, even with a drastic cut in depression and suicidality. Other mental health determinants must be addressed as well, including gender minority stress, which will take a multi-pronged approach inclusive of medical, social, educational, and policy-level interventions. The study selection of patients was likely biased, representing the youth with the highest tier of supportive caregivers who had resources to access a gender-affirming care clinic. And despite this, there were very high rates of depression, anxiety, and suicidality. Youths who are unable to access gender-affirming care owing to a lack of family support or resources require particular emphasis in future research and advocacy, they concluded. Okay, well, wanted to end the show's news reporting with something that might be a little bit more upbeat news, but a very interesting perspective on happiness and the pursuit of happiness, which, of course, I've reported time and time again, is a public health issue, but there are some really interesting nuances brought out by this article from Medical Express. Why the pursuit of happiness can be bad for you and what you should pursue instead. Happiness is one of the most important goals in life. During the pandemic, it trended as the most searched word on Google. But here's why the pursuit of happiness can be bad for you. It can make us more self-centered. The active pursuit of happiness can exacerbate individualistic tendencies to seek out pleasures at the expense of others, such as breaking up a friendship because it's not fun, expense of society, driving fast may make you happy but endangers other people's lives, or the expense of the environment, keeping the air conditioning running overnight. Ironically, that self-centeredness, apart from not serving others well, also makes people who pursue happiness more lonely. Focused on making ourselves happy, we forget the basic principle of happiness, which is to look outside ourselves for true happiness. Those who score the highest in any happiness ranking report good social support. For instance, supporting others when in need and in return being offered support. Live meaningful lives that allow them to contribute to society, such as putting effort into developing skills that serve others well. Experience abundance of positive emotions, which are often created in a company of others. We smile 30 times more often in group than in solitude. This is the irony of the single-minded pursuit of happiness. Focusing on ourselves and wanting to be happier reduces our chances of experiencing happiness. It can make us realize that we're unhappy. The idea that we should be searching for it can highlight the absence of happiness in our lives. The more we value happiness, the more likely it is that we will be disappointed with our current situations. Even worse, the more desperate we become about finding happiness, the more likely we are to experience symptoms of depression. It can make us blame ourselves for being unhappy. The implication that we should all be happy and that is easy to achieve can make us feel like there's something wrong with those who are not happy, causing further distress. Our obsession with happiness has spawned an industry of people and organizations promising quick fix ways to make us happy. This is just one of the reasons why the narrow focus on happiness can be damaging. Apart from happiness not being good for the pursuers, it is often inappropriate to talk about happiness when interacting with people suffering extreme poverty, experiencing political injustice, living through devastating conflicts, or facing natural disasters. To put it simply, being happy is not a priority in these situations. Advocating for initiatives to increase happiness can lead to people feeling alienated and misunderstood. In traumatic times, exhorting people to, quote, be happy can come across as tone deaf or lacking in compassion. So boost your well-being instead. If we focus too narrowly on the pursuit of happiness, we are at risk of forgetting about well-being, which runs deeper than simple hedonism and includes connections with people, life purpose, a sense of accomplishment, and self-worth. Here are five ways to improve your well-being. 1. Ensure that you can meet the basic needs of yourself and those you care for. 2. Allocate regular time for pleasurable activities, such as a walk, playing a game, or watching or listening to something you enjoy. 3. Invest in building and maintaining positive relationships. Meet with friends, keep in contact with family members, nurture your work relationships. 4. Stay connected with what makes your life meaningful. For example, supporting a movement, following a faith, or committing fully to your personal or professional role. 5. Make things better for your community by, say, advocating for better services, volunteering in your community, or challenging unfair practices. Well, good advice for better well-being. Okay, well, we've come to the part of the show where we're going to highlight bonus articles that you can read online. I'll give you the link where you can read these online articles and also get links to all the stories that I've covered today during this episode. So I had a dozen bonus articles this week, down from the previous couple weeks where I hit a dozen and a half. Okay, first up, to restore public trust, the CDC must stop legitimizing the expulsion of asylum seekers. 2. 20 years ago, a landmark report spotlighted systemic racism in medicine. Why has so little changed? 3. Minority women most affected if abortion is banned or limited. 4. We need more illustrations of people of color in medical textbooks. The lack of diversity perpetuates health inequality and stereotypes. 5. Healthcare firms were pushed to confront racism. Now some are investing in black startups. This is a story of one of the few black venture capitalists who's making this happen. And sort of related to that, 6. The nation hasn't made much progress on health equity. These leaders forged ahead anyway. That's sort of what leadership is. And 7. Researchers say science skewed by racism is increasing the threat of global warming to people of color. Need to get people of color involved in their own lives for all of our lives to be better. 8. The stumbling block to one of the most promising police reforms. The best mental health responders in the world can help only if emergency dispatchers know when to deploy them. This is another one of the aspects of the so-called defund the police movement, where you move resources from high resource intense interventions like law enforcement to more appropriate and actually lower resource intensive interventions like actually having mental health responders deal with mental health crises, not making mental health crises a law enforcement problem. Okay, 9. U.S. plans new safety rules to crack down on carbon monoxide poisoning from portable generators. This is a follow-up from a story that I reported on in an earlier episode from ProMedica. And this is a good example of how investigative journalism can make a difference. And another follow-up to my coverage of antibiotics and how we need to have stewardship over their use. Groups urge McDonald's to honor antibiotics commitment, which it made a number of years back and has failed to do. And a very interesting article here on how health professionals can make a difference in the world. 11. How psychologists can engage in civil disobedience to defend ethical principles. And this is around specifically the example of psychologists having to deal with anti-trans legislation. And 12, last but not least, a story that's near and dear to my heart, what I learned from Paul Farmer. Treat the systems around the patient, not just the disease. Paul Farmer died this last week at age 62, perhaps a little prematurely. He was a force of nature. He's close to my heart because one of the places he spent most of his time was in Haiti, the place of my birth and the poorest place in the Western Hemisphere. And he has traveled around the world healing and training and advocating and setting up systems for the most vulnerable in the world. And he did it not just by setting up clinics, but by treating the systems and engaging and strengthening the cultures to a culture of health. Amen. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Jon Snow Memorial Studio. Jon Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some justice.